Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas. This is the Christmas Eve edition of The Horn. It is already Christmas Day in far-flung Australia, so happy Christmas to all The Horn listeners that-a-way. I hope you have a joyous, joyous Christmas morning. And Christmas is on the way for the rest of the world, not far away at all, and in fact, darn near here in parts of Europe and the Middle East. Very Merry Christmas, world, from little old us here in the hills and hollers of almost level West Virginia. Now, I'm not one that goes in for omens or anything, but then again, you know, I'm not Roman Catholic. But if you're Roman Catholic, you got to be feeling a little creepy about Christmas. No, not because of the liberal war on Christmas or anything, but because apparently the Vatican has just broken with something on the order of probably 1,000 or 2,000 years of history, and it took an old former Nazi anti-aircraft gunner pope to break that tradition. How ironic. No, actually, it's not ironic. It's more like how suited it is. Have you seen this story? Things are not well at St. Peter's Basilica. Not well at all. Chicken Noodle News reporting that His Holiness, Benny the Rat, Benny Ratzinger, fell. He's 83 years old, and you know, that fall, it's not good when you're 83. CNN reporting, an unidentified person tried to reach Pope Benedict XVI during the start of midnight mass on Thursday, but was intercepted by security. That's right. The Vatican has security. Isn't that kind of like putting a lock on a door of the store that's open 24 hours a day? It just doesn't quite fit, does it? But I guess somebody tried to, and you know, Vicar of Christ, right? Somebody tried to get up to Benny Ratzinger, and he was wrestled to the ground, but not before, I guess, the Pope took a tumble. Vatican spokesman Federico Lombardi told Agence France-Presse, "It is a sensible precaution, and there is no cause for concern or alarm." Yeah, all Vatican spokesmen are Father Guido Sarducci to me, okay? I'm sorry, it just are. For some reason or another, several weeks ago, Vatican officials, that's just what they're called in the story, decided that midnight mass would be celebrated at 10 p.m. instead of midnight. Well, you know, when you're infallible, 10 p.m. can be midnight now, can't it? The story says, the Christmas season is one of Pope Benedict XVI's busiest periods, and officials say they did not want to tire His Holiness out for the important Urbi et Orbi blessing, the city and the world, Urbi et Orbi blessing from St. Peter's Basilica at noon. So this is the first time, period, that the world-famous Midnight Mass at St. Peter's ain't going to be at midnight. Reckon it's over by now. I don't know, or is it... But during the scuffle to bring the man to the ground, His Holiness got knocked down. Like I said, that's a bad omen. That's a very bad omen. If you're into omens and so forth. And, you know, call me crazy, but isn't there that place in the Bible where Jesus is walking around amongst the multitudes and they're all kind of getting up trying to touch him because he's a holy man, and the woman of faith who knew that she could be healed if she but touched the hem of his garment? Well, there ain't going to be no garment hem touching for Pope Benedict Ratzinger.
I will not have people touching the hems of my garments. That is fire! Clink!
So, who knows? But there are... Oh, Christmas 2009 is off to a rough start in Rome. But that's okay. That's okay, because Christmas isn't Rome. Christmas is something that happens inside the souls of individual... To the extent, yeah. The spirits, or whatever, of individual human beings. But Christmas is off to a rough start for Wingnuts, too. I don't know if you caught this or not, but with the passage of the Senate health care bill, 60-39, that imprecatory prayer works. Because Tom Coburn said the only hope was if one senator didn't show up for the vote. And lo and behold, one senator didn't show up. I got this from our buddy Corey in Louisville. Hey, Bob, I happen to be a resident with probably the worst Senate representation in the country, with chinless Addison Mitchell McConnell, and this one's for Wayne. There's another southern person with three last names for a first name, Addison Mitchell McConnell. Chinless Addison Mitchell McConnell, R, Humana, and Carpetbagger from Alabama. Ooh, I didn't know that. Oh, that even sucks worse. And senile Jim Bunning, R, batshit crazy, speaking on behalf of the people of Kentucky. Thankfully, I have John Yarmuth, D, Louisville, as my congressman. As an aside, can some progressive state just adopt us here stranded in Louisville? The entire state hates us, yet we provide the tax dollars that they can give away to King Cole to blast out the mountains of eastern Kentucky. Anyway, guess which senator missed the historic health care vote taken this morning? One hint, it wasn't anyone with a D next to their name. What happened to Jim Bunning? Did he die? Did our side pray for the wrong guy? How hard did you pray? Well, speaking of Jimbo Bunning, you see the poll numbers for this race? Trey Grayson, Secretary of State, and you got to pay attention here, it gets a little complicated. Trey Grayson, Secretary of State and student of Addison, that would be Addison Mitchell McConnell, Chinless Mitch, trails Rand Paul, yes, that Rand Paul, son of Ron Paul. You know, he named his son Rand for his BFF crush, Ayn Rand, I know, you, for the Republican nomination for Senate, mostly from the teabaggers, and mostly because Grayson is a former Democrat, and we all know we need party purity to make Merca the best country in the world. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, homophobe mountaintop removal supporting anti-healthcare reform Dr. Daniel Mangiardo, who is also favored by the DSCC, trails an actual Kentucky Progressive Attorney General Jack Conway, but surprisingly both trail Rand Paul of all people in the general, which is big news. See, while Grayson is a Republican, Corey says Republican, sorry, that's a habit. He's always won big, especially in the very few blue parts of the state. He's getting beat by a teabagger with little name recognition. Fun times in the bluegrass. Corey says, see you during Big East season. I hope you guys get your licks in now on the University of Louisville fighting Cardinals, because it will not last much longer. Ha ha. We shall see. But yeah, in answer to the question, Corey pointed it out. There's them Republicans doing all that imprecatory praying that one senator won't show up for the historic vote. Just one. Oh, Jesus, just one senator. That's all we need to not show up. Just one. Oops. Turned out to be one of their own. Jim Bunning, crazier than a sprayed roach. Yeah, I don't know. Too many bean balls on the old baseball diamond or something, but he ain't home. No, Jim Bunning didn't show up. And it panned, and then the health care bill passed in the Senate 60-39. Because when you've got a Republican minority in the Senate, a majority consists of 60 votes out of 100, not 51. You know, it's that Republican math made easy. But anyway, the bill did pass, and they were having some conversation on C-SPAN, at which point the host on C-SPAN took a call from Kansas, from a distraught, presumably teabagging wingnut. And I want to go back just for a minute to something that I alleged last night, and that is the difference in the manipulation of anger between the two sides on this issue. The right wing has been manipulated into fury, which will then lead to them turning out in droves at the polls. The left wing has been manipulated into impotent anger, which hopefully the way that Republicans are playing this will lead to them sitting home and not going to the polls. Because remember, not showing up at the polls always benefits Republicans. It never benefits Democrats. Democrats always benefit from high turnout. And so you see what's going on here. So anyway, the guy on C-SPAN takes a call. And I'm surprised it wasn't from Idaho or Utah or Oklahoma or Alabama or Mississippi or even West Virginia. No, it was from Kansas, which we kind of hoped was sort of turning around, but apparently not entirely, not for Bunny from Kansas. This what you were about to hear, my friends, this Christmas Eve, is the sound of one pissed off wingnut.
Kansas, this one from Bunny, Parson, Kansas. You're opposed to the bill.
Good morning. Yes, I am, very much. I am so disappointed. I have taken my Christmas tree down. I've taken my Christmas wreath off my house. I've taken all the lights down. This is supposed to be a nation under God, and it isn't. They absolutely have ruined Christmas for all of the senators and representatives that are supposed to be under God. This is God's holiday for the birth of his son.
So you took down your Christmas tree because of the Senate health care bill?
I certainly did, and I would like to see every light in the nation go out, and especially in the White House. This is just ridiculous.
Why are you so opposed to it, Bunny?
Because it's divisive between my son, who is younger, and myself. And in many families, it's that way. Either it's genocide on the seniors with this hospice that's never supposed to be supported by federal or state money. They are a not-for-profit organization that Germany has even kicked out. Germany, France, China, Japan, Sweden's trying to get rid of them. The UK is saying, well, maybe we had better get rid of them. Scotland wouldn't have anything to do with them. What are we doing paying these people to kill other people? That's what they do.
All right. Larry in Aurora, Colorado.
You know, I kind of feel sorry for the C-SPAN guy because that's one of those moments where, but, you know, they're far too serious at C-SPAN to do what I would do, and that would be to cue up that clip from the Donald Fagan's The Night Fly. You say there's a race of men in the trees. You're for tough legislation. Thanks for calling. I wait all night for calls like these. Sorry, don't mean to get all bumbled, but what do you do with a dead from the neck up like Bunny from Parson, Kansas? I mean, can you imagine her? I mean, that's the central time zone, so it's like 6:22 in the morning, and Bunny's already got the wreath down. She's taken the Christmas tree down. She's pulled all the lights, and she wants to see how the lights go out all over America, because this is a nation under God. What do you do with people like this? Well, there's a bit of a hint. I shared, you know, I do some writing on the side. And I shared a recent song lyric that I had written with a few people. I'm not going to read it or anything. But one of the people I sent it off to, just for, you know, for review purposes, was our critic at large, Reverbo. I mean, what the heck's the point of having a critic at large if you're not sending him stuff to critique? John Fox has it in his hands as well. It may get turned into a song. It's the first time I can recall that I've ever written a song that wasn't a parody, that is deserving of its own music and its own tune and stuff. The thing is called Almost Heaven, of course. You know me. Reverbo wrote back to me about it. And in writing about it, he said, with the right band doing it and rednecks who finally decide to listen and notice and want to improve themselves, then put this in the rotation on WNEK. We neck. By the way, their logo is a toothless possum with a baseball cap, which pisses off the possum goddess to no end. But he said, I love this verse. Daddy strips mountains for the coal company. They said he didn't need no GED. It was that or get blown up by an IED, and Daddy couldn't even spell Afghani. And Reverbo said, what morons like Daddy need to finally get through their thick Neanderthal skulls is that the forces they mistakenly think are their benefactors are in fact systematically taking things away from them. It amazes me how people who are fighting for a clean, safe, prosperous future, sometimes referred to as a better life for everyone, are presented as being against freedom. We don't just need more money on our side. We need a killer PR team who's raring to feed on the enemy like sharks. The word of the hour is relentless. The diarist over at Daily Coast, there is no spoon. Nay, know of one. It was Reverbo who first sent that essay along. And started and, you know, threw the pebble into the pond that's created all the ripples. That thing made some noise. Reverbo continues, the real enemies of this country are indeed within this country. They perpetuate the concept that we are not all in this together, that we are not all downstream, and to take what you can get and screw everybody else. That's freedom in the conservative economic model. And if you're so lost that you don't see this for the poison that it is and try to change it or change yourself, you will simply be fodder for them. Pretty strong, huh? The problem with the NASCAR crowd, says Reverbo, is that when things become unstable, like they are now, they don't have the sophistication to process or evaluate it with any clarity or logic. Hence, Bunny from Parson, Kansas, who at 6 o'clock in the morning was in some sort of frenzied right-wing booger-eating teabagging rage, ripping her Christmas tree down. All they want to do is hit somebody. I just want the cold country to be dark. Remember? Joseph Goebbels and his modern-day disciples understand this and provide them with self-serving scapegoats. Reverbo notes, I will repeat what I've said before. The necks have had more than enough time to buy a ticket on the bus, and the bus is already way behind schedule. I'm tired of waiting for them, or anyone else who wants to remain in the wilderness. They don't have any power, they just have the mouth. We have to build a new future, and if you don't get it by now, then I'm ready to leave you behind where you evidently wish to be. Just write them off once and for all, together with the creationists and all the rest of the brainless idiots. We don't have time for this anymore. There you go. I just turned into a me, not a wee vampire. See how easy that is? No, it's not the same. And he signs off saying, this has been Reverbo, your critic at large, together with the possum goddess, wishing you and yours a happy solstice and productive 2010. I'll tell you, it had better be more productive for me, lest I slide even more precariously into the hole I'm in. It's a big hole, Reverbo, and there's bunches of us in it. And all we got in common is our misery, and the least we can do is share it. But isn't Bunny the audio poster child for Get a Brain, Morans? She has been whipped, if she is telling the truth. And you know what? Being a booger, bagger, birther, denther, tenther, deather, booger eater, I think she probably is. She got, the right wing whipped her into such a murderous frenzy that she destroyed Christmas in her own household. But you know, there was that nugget of truth. I hate them for the divisiveness. And this part she gets right. I hate them for the divisiveness. And she notes, they have divided. She said, my son is considerably younger than me. And they've divided my son and me. Because obviously, her son wants everyone to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick. Not that this health care bill provides it. And she feels like her son is now part of some assault on her. Did you hear her use the word genocide in regard to America's senior citizens? That's how effective the right-wing hate machine is. They've got a woman, a lonesome woman, in Parson, Kansas, believing that her own son wants to kill her now for socialized medicine. I'm not trying to be a Christmas Eve bummer or anything, everybody, but this is serious. And half of our side are pissed off. Right before the show, Wayne sent me a link to Crooks and Liars. You know, we go there all the time. About the passage of the bill, and it's a Susie Madrack column. Sanders' deal lays the groundwork for national health care. And Katrina Vandenhoevel at The Nation, writing about the deal, writes as follows. Without fanfare, the good senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, has continued to work behind the scenes to champion community health centers, something he has done for years. These nonprofit community-based facilities provide primary health care, dental care, mental health services, and low-cost prescription drugs on a sliding scale. As amendments were added in recent days to win over the Liebermans and Nelsons of the greatest undemocratic deliberative body in the world, Sanders made sure that $10 billion increase in funding for the health centers was included. And this is probably the most rational statement I've heard on this health care bill yet. This is not going to solve all the problems of the world, Senator Sanders said yesterday. But expanding access to high-quality primary health care and low-cost prescription drugs and mental health counseling and dental care, which is a big issue, this is a very significant step forward. If you walk into a health clinic and you have no insurance at all, they will treat you on a sliding scale basis. So that's affordable health care. And, you know, and I'll add that somebody walking into one of those clinics is not walking into an ER, which is a huge part of the waste that is involved in our medical system. Using emergency rooms for primary care is cripplingly expensive and dangerous, too, because it takes care away from people who desperately need it on an urgent basis. Katrina Vandenhoevel notes, there's also been little news coverage of Sanders' fight to allow states waivers so they can move forward with their own health insurance concepts, including single payer. Well, 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 something that Dennis Kucinich fought so darned hard for in the House, and Bernie Sanders is making progress on it in the Senate. She notes such language is now in the Senate bill, and Sanders is still working with Senator Ron Wyden to strengthen it. Well, the bill's it's over. The bill's passed. But this is the important part. That is exactly how Canada developed its health care system, with a successful program incubated in Saskatchewan. This provision is actually stronger in the Senate bill. It didn't make it into the House version. Bernie Sanders says it's still in play. And then you go down to the comments. And then you begin to see what the problem is. You get a sense for the gravity and the depth of the problem we face. Comment one. Oh, two. Comment two. Did Sanders vote for this historic Christmas Day crap on the American people, or was he a nay? Comment three. Gee, thanks, Congress. Now I get to get crappier insurance for more money. Go F yourselves. Hey, it's not that bad. It's the power to force you to buy a horrible product you don't want from a disreputable monopolistic corporation that pays regular bribes to your elected representatives in the form of campaign contributions. Nothing major, right? Like I said, the right has been whipped into an activist fury. And they are going to whip your ass. Sorry to say this on Christmas, but it's true. And I don't take time out at Christmas for fantasy. Well, except among, you know, toddlers and the like. Because we're going to let them have a little bit of magic before we, you know, explain to them what a miserable mess we've created in the world. But where this is concerned, no. The right wing is going to stay whipped up, stay ginned up, stay absolutely crazier than a sprayed roach, stay just decon-huffing insane. And they're going to stay that way until November 2010, and they're going to try to spread their madness. They're going to try to infect other people with it. And lo and behold, they've managed to infect, cross-contaminate the liberal side, but damned if the liberal side doesn't respond to the disease differently. And we say, well, screw it. We'll just stay home in 2010 and let the country go to hell. Burn, baby, burn, right? But this is by far not a done deal. And it's going to conference committee. Sandra says, I hear you, Bob, but will it get stripped out? And what can we do to keep it in the final bill? We can do the only thing we have that we're even remotely allowed to do. We can make noise. I didn't know it was in the bill until Wayne sent me that post from Susie Madrake. I'm told it's Madrake, not Madrak. To each his own. Wish your name was Smith. But that's my problem and not yours. I didn't even know it until I read her article. And that's encouraging. And if it is true that that's how they built it in Canada, then for God's sakes, let's build this. And let's do what we can do. And what we can do is to say, keep it in the bill. How about that? There's something more liberal in the Senate bill than is in the House bill. Bernie Sanders accomplished what Dennis Kucinich could not. And it has to stay in it when it goes to conference. And the argument about it is that it can stay in it simply because, well, it passed the Senate, so we don't have to worry about it. So get busy. Find out what provision that is within the Senate bill, and get busy with your member of Congress so that they can communicate to the conference committee. We want that provision to stay in. We want the community health care centers to stay in. And then we stay on them. I'm sorry, it's not pitchforks and torches, but it's what we have. It's what we have. Citizen advocacy. Do it. We've got a couple of weeks, you know, they're going to go off on vacation. They've gone off on vacation. I imagine the halls of the Senate and the Hart Senate Office Building and the Russell Senate Office Building and that one in the middle that's real 1950s sort of Soviet-style architecture in the middle, real drab, gray, icky, yeah. What is the name of that one? It starts with a D, I think. Dirksen. Hello. They're empty. They're gone on vacation. But come Monday, their local offices will be open. And you can tell your senators that you want it to stay in the conference committee. You know, I wish I had the force and effect of a move on, say. Because then we could send out an email asking for everybody for $5 and asking them to put their name on a petition that we could then deliver to Congress, you know, and have a million names or a million, a hundred, whatever, saying that we want the community health care centers and we want, well, that we want what we want. But I can't, so it's up to, you know. It's up to you to make some noise. You'll recall Reverbo noting that if the teabaggers don't want to get on the bus, he's ready to leave them. He sends another email in saying, you know, if we're so smart, why ain't we rich? Miss Bunny obviously isn't standing in the ticket line. And, you know, I just remembered that wasn't Sergeant Carter's girlfriend in Gomer Pyle, USMC, wasn't she Miss Bunny? We know where she retired. But on that ticket out of the wilderness, no, Miss Bunny obviously isn't standing in the ticket line. And Reverbo notes, everywhere on the right and far too often on the left, it's a bozo explosion. And I will leave Reverbo to explain a bozo explosion. He can do it ever so much better than I. By the way, some good news. You know, we talked about General Dreidel, who had imposed that rule about his female soldiers not getting all pregnant and stuff, and how he's going to put them in the guardhouse if they done it. Well, and yesterday we had the announcement from him saying, well, we're not going to put them in jail or nothing, but we're not going to give them Plan B neither. We don't want them pregnant, but once they're pregnant, we're going to make sure that they give birth to that heroic little American. Amen, sweet Jesus. Hallelujah. My eyes have seen the glory. Not so much. Because if you remember your Catch-22, and for those of you who have not read it, buy it for yourself for Christmas, and open the first page one and start laughing, and then get all the way to the end and realize that you've been laughing all along at the same time that you've been learning some real horrific stuff. But in Catch-22, there are two generals. There's not just General Dreidel. General Dreidel is the one who wanted to put the pregnant soldiers in the guardhouse. No, there's also General P.P. Peckham. And General P.P. Peckham and General Dreidel were always trying to countermand each other. And it would appear that General P.P. Peckham has indeed countermanded General Dreidel again. General P.P. Peckham, otherwise known as General Ray Odierno, said the new Iraq-wide guidelines would take effect beginning January 1, lifting rules enacted by the U.S. commander in northern Iraq, who reports to, that would be General Dreidel, who reports to General P.P. Peckham, although he would never admit it in public, that laid out possible punishments for pregnancy among his soldiers. General Peckham, or Odierno, said, that will not be in my orders from January 1st. Oh, well, you know, someone call former Corporal Wintergreen, because that is not Prolix prose. That will not be in my orders from January 1. Between now and January 1, who knows. But it's also something else this day. And this is a bitter pill and a tough one to swallow. Today, oddly enough, this very day, marks the 3,000th day of our war against the people of Afghanistan. The 3,000th day of a war that has seen us slaughter civilians with all too competent abandon. And it's also the 30th anniversary of the Soviet invasion. Odd how those two things come together. The 30th anniversary of the Soviet invasion and the 3,000th day of our war against those poor, poor, poor people in Afghanistan. Those numbers were noted by a 24-year Navy veteran, Representative Eric Massa, a Democrat from New York. He had an op-ed in the Hill paper yesterday, and he wrote, as we begin our deployment of 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan, this Christmas Eve will also mark the 3,000th day of the war in Afghanistan and the 30th anniversary of the initial Russian invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Thus far, this war has already cost the American taxpayers a minimum of $300 billion, according to the Congressional Research Service. And that's just the funding that's on the budget. Sadly, the fact that we're spending about $101 million per day in this war is the good news. The financial cost of this war is nothing compared to the fact that 937 American troops have been killed and 4,434 have been wounded, and that's not counting the thousands more that will carry the memories of this war for their entire lives. Congressman Massa says, exactly 50 days ago from Christmas Eve, because of all these reasons, I took to the floor of the House and formalized my call for an end of this war of occupation and attrition. As a 24-year retired military officer and former special assistant to then Supreme Commander of NATO General Wesley Clark, I am deeply troubled by the fact that we have yet to even define victory. Having recently witnessed an election where Hamid Karzai won despite having about one-third of his ballots thrown out for election fraud, I also know that we cannot continue engaging in nation-building by partnering with one of the most corrupt narco-governments in the world. Additionally, being on the House Armed Services Committee and having listened to the testimony of General Stanley McChrystal, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Mike Mullen, there is nothing that convinces me that we can force democracy on a tribal people through continued military operation or escalation. He continues, history has shown us what happens when military forces try to occupy Afghanistan, and we can learn a lot from the Russian invasion, which began on December 24, 1979. Indeed, we can. Among other things, former Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev was asked about Afghanistan. When asked what lessons he learned, that President Obama should maybe pay attention to in making his decisions about Afghanistan, Gorbachev said, quote, one was that problems there could not be solved with the use of force. Such attempts inside someone else's country end badly. What a phrase, end badly. That's almost minimalist when you get right down to it. They end badly. You said a mouthful, Buster. And it goes hand in hand with a little something that I saw in the New York Times back a few days ago. The headline said, and I was just looking at the Times website, and it just sort of, you know how it is, a headline will just grab your eye. Afghan killing bears a Karzai family feud. And it's a little bit complicated, but this, understand, this is the country we're going to fix by shooting it some more. An article by James Risen in the New York Times, published December 19, 2009, Dateline Washington. On October 16th, four sport utility vehicles barreled into Kars, Afghanistan, the hometown of the country's president, Hamid Karzai, and pulled up to the home of one of his cousins, Yar Mohammed Karzai. Teams of armed guards blocked the street and herded passersby into a nearby mosque while seizing their cell phones, and then removed the front door of the house, according to Karzai family members and several people from the mosque. A man in traditional white Afghan robes, accompanied by two security guards, walked inside and found two of Yar Mohammed Karzai's children, 18-year-old Wahid and his 12-year-old sister Sona, doing their schoolwork in their bedroom. The little girl later said that she remembered that the robed man raising a pistol and shooting Wahid three times as she shouted, "Don't kill my brother! Don't kill my brother!" Then the intruders left, firing their weapons. And a cousin, Zalal Karzai, 25 years old, came running from somewhere else in the house and said, and saw Wahid stagger from the bedroom. "What happened to you?" Zalal Karzai recalled asking. "Hashmat shot me," said the youth, screaming. Wahid Karzai died 2 days later at an American military hospital in Kandahar. And he told the story a couple more times. How 40-year-old Hashmat Karzai, a first cousin of President Hamid Karzai, and the owner of a private security company that has close ties to the Afghan government and millions of dollars in contracts with the United States military, had come in and shot him in the head. We're going to fix this. We're going to make this stop happening by shooting the country some more. Are you down with that logic? Can you make it work inside your head? Because I'm not having so much luck. Some relatives said they believed... Jesus. Merry Christmas. Some relatives said they believed that the death was vengeance for an honor killing of Hashmat Karzai's father 30 years ago by Yar Mohammed Karzai. For his part, Hashmat Karzai said, "I had nothing to do with this. The boy was shot by drug dealers who meant to hurt someone else. They mixed up the houses and they killed the boy by mistake. I had nothing to do with it." By the way, this democracy that we are fostering in Afghanistan, you know, the Afghan government, it really hasn't investigated the killing at all. A little bit even. No. Not even, no. And, well, you know, the FBI, they went and, what the hell is the FBI doing in Afghanistan, unless Afghanistan's the 51st state? Well, but anyway, the FBI questioned Hashmat Karzai a month ago. They came. We talked. We had tea. But an FBI spokesman is declining to comment on the matter. And there's nothing to indicate that the FBI is doing anything about it, assuming that they have the right to. Yar Mohammed Karzai, 62, has said, "Not a single soul has come to investigate. I told one local official, what do you want me to do, knock on Obama's door?" Noor Karzai is 40, and he lives in Maryland. And he said, "They are protecting Hashmat. He is sitting in Kabul getting money from the U.S. government. No one will touch him. We are sending billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer money to Afghanistan, and this is how the government operates." Someone tried to reach the office of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, and a spokescreep there said, the case is a criminal matter. Wow, really? So, just understand that what Representative Massa is talking about bringing to an end is an occupation that fosters this kind of... Can you... 17 years old, sitting there doing maybe his physics homework... One hopes, instead of maybe, studying the Quran or, figuring out how many angels can dance on the head of a pin or whatever. Please let it be his physics homework. Well, it's too late anyway, because the kid's dead. It was like something out of Miami Vice, only without the pastel clothing. Family members are nervous about talking about the story because they're afraid Hashmat will come and kill them too. He has been repeatedly the eyewitness ID'd as the robed man who exited the house. Allegations exist that Ahmed Wali Karzai has been involved in, of course, drug trafficking. Mahmoud Karzai has been accused of exploiting his family name to get lucrative business deals. Wow, and we thought we had it tough with Billy Carter. And the roots of the dispute, we're not going to fix this. The roots of the dispute go back to when Yar Mohammed Karzai, who, remember, he's 62 now, goes back to when he was 5, and his father arranged a marriage between him and another Karzai cousin. Sure do got a pretty mouth. But when the girl grew up, she left Kars, became a teacher, married another man, and eventually settled in the United States. So relatives say that Yar Mohammed Karzai was angered by the woman's rejection and her family's failure to make amends by offering a formal divorce or an apology. So to punish her family, Yar Mohammed Karzai shot Khalil Lula Karzai, the girl's brother, in 1982 or 1983 in Quetta, Pakistan, where both men were then living. He, of course, was never charged with the murder. Yar Mohammed Karzai said he knew it was not over. "I never felt comfortable with the closing of this story, and neither did Hashmat." But Hashmat says it's not quite like that. Hashmat says, "The father killed my father. We captured him more than 10 years ago and brought him to Pakistan, and we choose to have forgiveness. In Islam, I have the right to kill him, but I choose not to do so." And then there's Hekmat Karzai. He runs the Center for Conflict and Peace Studies, a think tank in Kabul that helps prop up the Karzai regime. Can we take all these Karzais and just change their names to Marvin Bush and George Bush and Jeb Bush? It sounds vague, surprisingly similar. Talk about cross-contamination. Whoa, we're looking at a Christmas Eve theme, I think. After Khalil Karzai's murder, his family moved to the U.S. and settled in Maryland. Hashmat, the oldest son, became an American citizen and until 2007 worked at a Toyota dealership in Virginia. That's when he went back to Afghanistan, where Hekmat is running the Center for Conflict and Peace Studies. You can sure study some conflict and peace when you bust through the door and blow the brains out of a 17-year-old boy who is peacefully doing his freaking homework. This is so twisted. Hashmat Karzai agrees that Wahid was an innocent victim, but he attributed his death to drug dealers. Hey, he said that Yar Mohammad Karzai and his brothers were involved in the drug trade. Yar Mohammad Karzai rejects that allegation. And that one of the brothers cheated some dealers. And intending to kill that man's son, they accidentally killed Wahid instead. He said he told President Hamid Karzai and Ahmed Wali Karzai that he played no part in the crime. Why would I do a killing there, right where I am building a house? That would be stupidity. The village of Kars, the story reports, is in Kandahar province, remember, named after Alexander, about 3 miles outside the city of Kandahar, where Ahmed Wali Karzai, one of the president's brothers, wields enormous political power. But, and you just gotta love the prose and the reportage prose involved here. But after Wahid's killing, government officials in the Kandahar area were strangely unhelpful, according to Yar Mohammad Karzai. Immediately after the shooting, Yar Mohammad Karzai said he called the nearest police station, but nobody answered the phone. Then he realized that the convoy had come to the shooting scene and gone without having to stop at a police checkpoint on the road into Kars. So then he calls a friend who works for Hamid Karzai, who gives him a private number for Ahmed Wali Karzai in Kandahar, and he gets somebody in that office and reports the killing, or the shooting. Some police show up later that night, collect some shell casings, and leave. It's not nearly as sexy as it is on CSI. The cops have not been back since. The Karzais who are in Maryland say that at least three of President Karzai's brothers, Ahmed Wali, Mahmoud, and Qayyum, have been urging family members to allow relatives to deal with the killing privately without bringing in the police. My mom talks to Qayyum and Ahmed Wali every day, said another family member in the United States. They both told her, why don't you keep quiet and we'll take care of it. Remember Sona, the 12-year-old little girl who was doing her homework too? She's not in the best of shape. She says, I can't sleep in my room anymore. I sleep with my parents now. Yep, we're going to bring democracy and civilization to these folks. Don't hold your breath. Alexander couldn't... Well, just stop, Bob. But Representative Massa is more than correct. We are not going to fix this. And bless his heart, he's calling for an up or down vote on the funding for the upcoming escalation of the war that Obama wants. And it wouldn't be a bad idea to try to be somehow supportive of that notion. Jude writes in and says, Bunny is a, going back to Bunny from Parson, Kansas. Bunny is sadly an example of those lost in the wasteland of ignorance, locked into the mindset of their earthly gods who spew out lies and distort for political reasons. The journey for anyone who has been fortunate to have had experienced hospice with the dedicated and truly loving staff would have been provided the insightful and life-altering preparation for tomorrow, each day's cup. For tomorrow, each day's cup fills us with the preparation for what lies ahead. Jude says we all will leave here one day, and to have been cared for in one's own home is the most honorable and precious way to take that last breath, surrounded by security of the familiar, the knowledge of those who love us, and the professional staff who have been called to do this work. Being lost becomes the individual's responsibility to first acknowledge the mistaken path, then seek assistance, and if willing to be open, redirect their steps to finding where the light is. Yet Bunny has removed all the lights in her home, even during what to many is the season of light and hope. Be well, Bunny, and may the Prince of Peace and Light present to you in the inner chambers of your self-made darkness a ray of clear-mindedness. Peace. Jude. Said in more gentle, much more gentle and humane terms than God knows I could have manifested. We are coming up on the end of this first hour of the allegedly Christmas Eve edition of the Horn. Coming up, we have the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And we certainly wish a happy Christmas to those two hardworking, hardworking broadcasters and bloggers. They do magnificent work. And in his during his vacation absence, Mike Malloy has once again tapped Brad to do the sit-in work next week. So don't let Brad feel lonesome. Give him lots of company. He'll do a great job. He always does. So we've got that coming up. And a little Christmas music here and there. What the heck? And a little bit later in the program, we're going to perpetuate something that we have done every year since this manifestation of the Horn began back in 2005. We're going to have the kids read the Christmas story. And this is something that I've wanted, that I've done every year as a sort of living record of an in audio form of the youngins growing up. And maybe in a few years, once they're all off to college, maybe Loney and Jasper will be doing the reading. But we'll have a record of hearing these little voices grow up. And so they will be by Margie and Ferg and Doodle to do the reading this evening. I've also got a favorite piece from Truman Capote that I hope to get done, just because it's my favorite piece of Christmas literature. And I don't know, but what we may bring Loney and Jasper in for a reading of The Night Before Christmas, otherwise properly titled A Visit from St. Nick by Charles Clement Moore. All that's coming. But before we get to any of that, there's time for a few phone calls, a little bit of Christmas music here and there. And, you know, I queued this Christmas song up just because I think it's one of my absolute favorites. I love John Lennon's Happy Christmas, War is Over. What was it, 1975, was it? And I think about what they were celebrating, because Vietnam had finally come to an end. And it's probably as profound a piece of Christmas music, lyric-wise, as anything out there. Certainly more profound than Jingle Bells. In terms of profundity, I put it up there with who is it, Greg Lake, I Believe in Father Christmas. Yeah. Ooh, probably ought to get to that one, too. So, on the way is the Christmas Eve edition of the Green News Report, and a little something from John Lennon. Happy Christmas. War is over. Honest to God, I can't wait until we can say that again. But we're not saying it this year. This is the horn.
So this is Christmas. And what have you done? Another year over. And you won't just be gone. And so this is
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, December 24, Christmas Eve, 2009.
Not a happy anniversary for a Tennessee town. Carping on invasive species in the Great Lakes. Big oopsie for Pittsburgh's childhood lead office. Plus, have a greener Christmas.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Prepare for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates the cap and trade will cost the average American household only $175 a year. Yes, because that study was authored by the rainbow pony flying out of Barack Obama's butt. Sparkle!
This is your Christmas Eve Green News Report.
Icicles on eavesdrops and tinsel on the tree, but it's a green Christmas for me.
All right, Des, well, Merry Christmas Eve to you.
Yes, Merry Christmas Eve to everybody. This week marks an unhappy anniversary for residents of Kingston, Tennessee, who got a nasty early Christmas present last year when a billion gallons of toxic coal ash waste burst its containment pond shortly after midnight and inundated 300 acres, contaminating nearby fields, streams, and rendering several homes uninhabitable. Coal ash waste is the toxic leftovers from burning coal. Nearly half of the nation's electricity comes from coal-burning power plants. Plants, generating 130 million tons of toxic waste every year that is permanently stored in loosely regulated waste ponds like the one in Tennessee. Tennessee authorities estimate cleanup of the toxic spill will take another 2 to 3 years and cost $1 billion.
For 30 years, Congress has been calling for the EPA to regulate toxic coal ash. Lisa Jackson of Obama's EPA has finally promised to do so. She promised to do so by the end of this year. She has failed to do it by the end of this year, but she says she will be doing it soon. I think we should take the opportunity here at the end of the year to give credit where it's due to the Obama administration on the EPA front and the climate front. They've been very, very good. Plenty of criticism for them elsewhere. But on the green issues, I think we've seen a sea change, certainly from the previous administration, no question about that.
Indeed. And the Obama EPA did promise to have new regulations by the end of this year, but that process has been stalled due to lobbying by the coal industry.
Really, you don't say. They don't want anyone to regulate them, just as they have gotten away with for the last 30 years? I'm shocked.
The state of Michigan sues the state of Illinois. The fight to save the Great Lakes from a voracious invasive species of fish has taken a new turn. We reported recently on efforts to stop Asian carp, an invasive species, from entering the Great Lakes. It's taken the carp only 15 years to spread all the way up the Mississippi River from Arkansas to Chicago. And the carp are now just miles away from the Great Lakes, threatening a $7 billion commercial fishing industry. Two man-made shipping locks are the last barriers to the Great Lakes, where Illinois Fish and Game officials have placed electrical barriers and even poisoned the waters last month in a last-ditch effort to stop the carp. But the state of Michigan says that's not good enough and is suing the state of Illinois in the Supreme Court. Michigan argues the only way to ensure the carp never enter the Great Lakes is to restore the natural land barrier by permanently closing the canals.
And these carp were put into the water some years ago by fish and game officials in hopes that they would actually clean out some of these lakes from the invasive weeds that had grown into them. But now, well, I guess this is the rule of unintended consequences.
Yeah, a rather stunning example of it. Pittsburgh's Office of Childhood Lead Prevention turns out to be contaminated with high levels of lead.
The office itself?
The office itself. Recent tests have shown that dust in the 90-year-old building has high levels of lead, probably due to peeling old paint. County officials dismissed the contamination as, quote, a housekeeping issue, claiming there's no cause for alarm since children are really only in the building for short periods of time. But one adult worker in the building was diagnosed with lead poisoning earlier this year.
Yeesh.
It's almost Christmas and almost New Year's, so there's no better time than now to green up your holidays. There are plenty of easy things that you can do, everything from choosing recycled wrapping paper to buying locally or making your gifts yourself or even baking them, reusing or recycling your trash and Christmas tree to divert as much waste as possible for landfills, or even choosing to give experiences rather than more stuff, like a trip to a favorite museum or a restaurant. We have lots of tips and tricks for you to green up your Christmas, including, here's a new one, If you find you have broken Christmas tree lights, get a jump on next year by recycling them and getting super efficient LED Christmas strings at the after holiday sales. LED Christmas lights use 90% less energy and last much longer, too.
And when you talk about more stuff, people need to understand that all of that stuff, even if it's not electrical stuff that uses a lot of energy, it uses a lot of energy and resources, most likely, in the distribution, in the manufacturing of the product. It is something to keep in mind.
Also, be sure to check locally for small charities and service organizations in your community that don't get as much attention as the big guys. Places like shelters for victims of domestic violence and children's hospitals who can make immediate use of your old toys, clothes, shoes, books, and appliances to help someone in your community get back on their feet again. And remember, even if you can't give money, you can give your time. And that's often the best gift of all and doesn't cost a thing.
We want to take this opportunity, both Desi and I, to wish all of our listeners on the air, on the radio, on the podcasts, the very merriest and greenest of Christmas. Read about all of our tips at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Christmas Eve Green News Report.
Red bows on the railing, snowflakes on the ground, but it's a green Christmas in this town.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Update from Rome, update from Rome. This just in. Reader of the entire internet. Gene, News Ninja Gene, has provided the background on what was apparently a tough night in Vatican City. Hard night on Vatican Hill. That sounds like some sort of 50s film noir piece, doesn't it? It turns out. Let's just go to the published Wire report and get to it. Let's see, where was it? Where did I put it? Oh, there it is. Headline, woman knocks down Pope at Christmas Eve Mass. A woman jumped the barriers in St. Peter's Basilica and knocked down Pope Benedict XVI as he walked down the main aisle to begin Christmas Eve Mass on Thursday. The 82-year-old Pope quickly got up and was unhurt, said Vatican spokesman Reverend Ciro Benedettini. Footage aired on Italy's RAI state TV showed a woman dressed in a red jumper. Well, she was vaulting over the wooden barriers, so of course she was wearing a jumper. It's Christmas, the jumper should be red. I think I'm missing the point. It showed a woman dressed in a red jumper vaulting over the wooden barriers and rushing the Pope before getting swarmed by bodyguards. If you're the vicar of Christ, don't you say, come, my child, come. Don't you do that? Maybe not. Because, see, Benny's evil little heart is so full of hate. You know, he hates gay people, he doesn't want people to, doesn't like women's insides. You know, there's a lot of sickness inside Benny's heart. And so he's probably not capable of manifesting that Yeshua-like spirit of, you know, let them come unto me. Because remember, the guy whose birth we're allegedly celebrating tomorrow, he had bodyguards, so to speak. Back then they called them disciples. And they'd say, you know, hey, get away from the boss. Get back. Give the guy a little, hey, let the boss breathe. Give it a little room here. And he'd say, you clueless, you don't get it. That's why I had to tell stories. That's why all those parables are out there, because he was talking to people like they were two-year-olds, because for the most part, they had the minds of two-year-olds. But the commotion occurred as the Pope's procession was making its way toward the main altar, and shocked gasps rang out. Really? A gasp can ring? This is by Ariel David of the Associated Press, and he has ringing gasps, I guess. Shocked gasps rang out through the public that packed the basilica. The procession came to a halt, and security rushed to the trouble spot. What's the problem here, Holy Father? Benedettini said the woman who pushed the Pope appeared to be mentally unstable. How could you tell? I mean, you got a whole bunch of people in there who believe in human parthenogenesis. No, really. You know, granted, parthenogenesis has been proven to occur in shark populations, but I don't think there's anybody out there arguing that Jesus was a land shark. Land shark. How can you tell that somebody's mentally unbalanced in that crowd? I mean, you got a room full of people talking to people who aren't there. How can you tell that one of them's a loony? She was arrested by Vatican police. If she was nuts, why didn't he heal her? You know, just get up, dust off the robes, and rub out the scuffs on the little magic slippers. Put the Wizard of Oz hat back on, and heal her. Not so much, I guess. Cardinal Roger Echegaray, who was taken to a hospital for a checkup, too, because she knocked him down as well. Was this woman a member of the Italian national rugby team? Benedettini's formal statement was, during the procession, an unstable person jumped the barrier and knocked down the Holy Father. The Pope quickly got up and continued the procession without healing this poor woman. Pope Benedict made no reference to the incident. Well, you know, that's the old juggler's rule. If you drop something, make it look like part of the act. Benedict made no reference to the incident as the service started. As the choir sang, he sprinkled incense on the altar before opening the Mass with the traditional wish for peace in Latin, Pax Vobis. Peace be with you. And the faithful responded, Et cum spiritu tuo. And they translate that as, and also with you. No. No. That would be, atque cum tuo. I think. Et cum spiritu tuo is, and the spirit be with you. I think. And by the way, it was the second year in a row that there's been a security breach at the service. At the end of last year's Mass, another deranged woman jumped the barriers to get close to the Pope. But she was quickly knocked to the ground, throw her to the floor, centurion, by security. Benedettini said it was not immediately known if the same woman was behind Thursday's incident. Jeez. Tough. I tell you, it's tough.
So let's go to the phones and see what's shaking. Hey, welcome to the program.
Couldn't be more madness, could it?
It sounds like madness to me, Jethro.
Yeah, that Pope stuff, that's some wild business there. That's the best mind lock, mind control game in the history of man.
Well, they've had 2,000 years to sort of perfect it.
Yes, they sure have. So, yeah. What's the difference between Santa Claus and Tiger Woods?
Oh, I'm afraid to ask.
Santa Claus stops at three hoes.
Right. I knew it had something to do with hoes. You're awful, and you're going to get a bundle of switches for Christmas.
That's something, isn't it?
Well, you know, I hold out for the switches because I don't want anybody getting a lump of coal, Jethro.
I hear you. So the hospice thing there, that was pretty wild. A lot of people are uneducated on hospice and, you know, its purpose and the whole deal like that. So I have firsthand knowledge. It's a good organization. They do a lot of good work. The public is still pretty much undereducated as to what they do, however.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you're very fortunate in Beckley in that you've got a magnificent hospice facility there that doesn't just do in-home, but also has a beautiful standalone facility Cranberry?
Yes, it's the...
Out the road from the Cranberry Grade School?
Yeah, but that's a separate entity. The field nurses are still over at Pinecrest Hospital, and they're hoping to get a bigger, larger, nicer place one day.
Well, it was at Hospice of Beckley out from Cranberry Grade School. That's where my father passed away. And it was,
yes.
To the extent that you can describe an event like that as being profound and spiritual and meaningful, it was all of those things.
Yes.
I mean, I literally got to live with my father the last few days that he lived, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. And I couldn't have done that in some sterile, antiseptic, god-awful hospital setting, Jeff.
No, you cannot do that in the hospital setting, which indeed is sterile and... impersonal to a degree, a lot more than what you like to think, because I've worked there as well. So, and it's not because you don't want to be, involved or something. You don't have time. You know, you got so many patients. You don't have time to do. I mean, this spiritual thing is, involved. But, you know, you're not as involved like it is in the complete transition that you see. You know, when you're working for hospice and. Yeah, and a lot of the times you have to work with the family members more than you do the patient. Some of them have accepted and are at peace with it, but the family members are not.
No.
So yeah, and some family members think are certain that a miracle is going to happen, and if the family members doesn't feel well or something, and they're not doing what they should be doing, there's a little bit of tension there, and you have to gently let those family members know that, well, they may want to get up and do this or that and do things that they used to, but it's like having the flu. You want to get up, but you don't feel like it. You can't. And, and it's not going to get better. And it's going to progress it's going to progress.
But you're absolutely right, Jethro. There's a ton of ignorance out there. I experienced it myself after my father passed away. One of my relatives said to me, and I know what you done. You took Daddy to that place where they just killed him. You got our Daddy killed. You know, talk about something that'll cut you deep.
Right.
But that's being cut by the knife of stupid, Jethro.
Yes, it is. And it's, the hospice house is set up to, for family and for comfort and a nice environment. And same thing at the home, you know, the family members and the person that's going through the dying stage, they want to go home and live life, and that's the purpose of hospice, to enable them to live life as fully as they can until the end. And
yeah, it's exactly as Jude described it, and of course Jude has worked in hospice, and she says that, you know, it's about being able to be in your familiar setting and surrounded by the love of family, the security of the familiar, knowledge of those who love us, and then a professional staff who've been called to do the work.
Right, and there's someone on call. I mean, you call and they're there taking care of business 24/7, 365. It's a different breed of nurse, too. There's no egos. There's no alpha females. There's no... it's just a teamwork effort and a lot of caring people, and it's a good thing. And and as you say, the hospital is such a dreary, it's a terrible, it's not a good place to go. And a lot of people get worried and rush the family members to the hospital and when they could have kept them home. And the hospice nurses train the family members as well in different things, and the medication's there, and sometimes the family members can give some medication, and sometimes they wait for the nurse to come, but it's a teamwork thing. And the dying process, I mean, that's the veil between death and life. You know, the afterlife starts to lift. And
well, you know, I'm kind of a hardcore rationalist, Jethro. So I one of the things by saying that, what I mean is I'm not going to suppose to tell anyone that I know what goes on after people go on. But I saw some pretty amazing things in that hospice room.
Right.
you can chalk it up to Dad being on some medication maybe, but he wasn't on any medication that was designed to make him hallucinate. And I sat there and saw him talking. He told our little Yorkshire Terrier, who had died a couple of years before, he told him to get off the bed. And then was satisfied when he did. And then began talking to relatives who had gone on long before him. And Agnes is much more sensitive to this kind of thing than I am. And she just said, Bob, they were coming to tell him it was time to come with them. And I don't know. But he seemed at peace with it.
Yes. Well, that's commonplace. And, you know, Dr. Raymond Moody has written books about, people coming back alive after death and things. But that is a commonplace, seeing relatives. And they're there, yeah, she was right. They're there to ease the transition. And that's what it is, it's transition. It's, you know, death is not final. I can remember when I was a kid, my great-grandmother was passing away, and my grandparents had come back and had said that, you know, Maude was talking out of her head. She'd seen, you know, these relatives who, you know, were long, long gone. She'd seen them in the room, and so I'd never.
I'm not going to sit there and tell anybody that they didn't.
It's real, and people a week or two, sometimes even more, before they pass away, they start talking about packing their bags, and start talking about the trip they're going on, or start talking about feeling like they're, you know, immersed in water and getting ready for the journey. So it's a transition.
Indeed, and, it is.
Yeah.
Well, are you all set for whatever sort of Christmas you're going to celebrate?
Actually, the big celebration was Monday. There.
Solstice, absolutely.
Yeah, solstice. That's the big celebration day. So. And I've seen Avatar on the computer. That's pretty wild. I can't wait to see it in 3D.
You know, that's one. There's not.
Okay, the three Kincaid kids are in here, and they're needling each other. They do that professionally, you know. So any noise in the background is them.
They're getting ornery.
Yeah, they're getting ornery. But what I was going to say is my gift to the family is to take everybody on Saturday to see Avatar in 3D.
And my birthday.
And it's also Ferg's birthday.
Woo! You come back native.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you've seen it, you know that I mentioned it on the show last night. There's a sort of Appalachian connection to the theory of the theme of the film.
Oh yeah.
You know, let's go to the distant land and take the black energy rock from the natives and kill them.
Right, and it doesn't matter how sacred the spot. The sacred spot has the richest deposit, so we got to get that. And you know, if we can't talk them out of moving. We've educated them, we've built schools for them, and they just won't listen. So, yeah, there's a lot of parallels to today. And
a little bit of Afghanistan, a little bit of Iraq, a little bit of Appalachia.
But the nature thing and the interconnectedness of everything, including the human, you know, or the not the humans, but the Na'vi, or that's the planet. I'm confused about the name of the planet and the.
Right.
There, the 12th that's all.
But, you know, I figure if we're going to see it, there's no sense in seeing it anywhere, something like that. There's no sense in seeing it anywhere but on a big screen.
Oh, yeah, and 3D, they say, is the best way to go. And it's pretty wild, a lot of the scenery. And the I've seen criticism where they say the storyline and the dialogue is pretty bad. But, of course, they said that about Star Wars, too. So.
Yeah, if Michael Medved hates it, I know I'm going to love it.
Yeah, and it's not anti-American. I mean,
no, but the right wing nuts sure are saying that it is.
Well, that's, you know, if you can't exploit and plunder, and you know, and that's what we're doing. You know, we've exploited and plundered and done this and that to keep our middle class standard of living high, and that's pretty much dry now. Now they've kind of turned on the middle class. They're sucking us dry now. We're being exploited and plundered and.
Yeah, Tim from L.A. is noting in the chat room, Jethro, that all the retardicans are hating Avatar.
But it's, it gives you the native side of the view and their interconnectedness, and it's a spiritual thing for them. And for the destruction and all that, that's, you know, that's taken away part of them. And that's a good thing. I hope a lot of kids get that, and you know, it makes an impression on them.
Well, I think it'll make an impression on this bunch. Jethro, I got to roll on because these kids are going to vibrate right off the planet if we don't get started here. But a very happy weekend to you, and we'll talk soon. Okay.
Right on.
All right, later, Jethro.
All right, Bob.
Bye now. That's our one of our oldest buddies there is. That's Jethro from over Beckley Way. I guess it's time for us to get started. So we're gonna have to operate with two microphones here. Now, Ferg, I'm serious.
I'm excited.
Straighten up.
I'm excited.
I know you are. Okay, where are you, Margie? Where are you going? They've all caught terminal giggles. Yeah. So, you know, we've got a recorded record of this happening for the last 4 years. 3 years? I don't know. But we've got a recorded record of them that you can literally hear the Kincaidlings grow up. And so now, in keeping with tradition, from the books of Matthew and Luke, as read first by Margie, then by Doodle, and then by Ferg, the Christmas story on the horn.
Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise. When as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph before they came together, she was bound with child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded that to put her away privily. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Ghost. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. Then Joseph, being raised from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord had bidden him, and took unto him his wife, and knew her not till she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name Jesus.
Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all the Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus is written by the prophet, And thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall be rule my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had privily called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared, and sent them to Bethlehem, and said, Go and search diligently for the young child, and when ye have found him, bring me word again, that I may come and worship him also. When they had heard the king, they departed, and lo, the star, which they saw in the east, went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return, they departed into their own country another way. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeareth to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise, and take the young child and his mother, and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I bring thee word. For Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night, and departed into Egypt.
And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was, that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you, ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God, and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace toward men of good will. And it came to pass, as the angels were gone far from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, Let us now go even unto Bethlehem, and see this thing which is come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste, and found Mary and Joseph, and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they had heard that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things, and pondered them in her heart.
Pretty good, guys. Nicely done. Thanks. And here in a little bit, excuse me, Ferg really wants to produce. Okay. See you in a bit. No, that way. Goodbye. No. Oh, shoot. Go on, Ferg. Go on, Ferg. Yes, it is almost your birthday. Go on. Here in a little bit, we will bring in Loney and Jasper and maybe read The Night Before Christmas. That seems more than appropriate. A little bit of that magic that I mentioned before they grow up enough for us to tell them what a wreck we've made of the place. One last thing, though. Doodle wants to sing. And I don't impose my children upon you very often. But there are not a lot of outlets for creative performance around here. And so, a cappella, a little rendition of that classic Christmas hymn, Silent Night, as performed by Doodle, who I think is going to come unglued. So stand by. This better be good, kid, or you'll never work in this business again.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round young virgin, mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace. Sleep in heavenly peace. Yay me.
Yay you, Doodle, yay you. And away you go. You know, I'm a little bit of a smart aleck, and I have to be careful about things. Love you, Doodle. You might have noticed the round young virgin in that rendition. I got it stuck in their heads because, you know, they were singing Christmas carols in the living room, and I popped in the other day and I said, you know, when I was little, I thought that they were saying Mary was fat, you know, round young virgin, when it's obviously round yon virgin. It stuck. Doodle auditioned earlier, and I said, yeah, well, maybe. But she sang round young virgin. I said, no, you got to get that straight. I didn't mean to do that to you. Like I said, you'll notice that it stuck. It's about 18 minutes before the hour, and let us go, yea, verily, unto yon phone and see what's happening. Hey, welcome to the program. Oh, darn. Well, shoot. The lines are open. We're not going to start up with any more stuff until the top of the hour. That gives you about 17 minutes if you want to jump in. Otherwise, I will just have to fill a Bobster. It's entirely your choice. Yeah. Oh. Thank you. Thank you. Lots of applause for. Lots of applause for Doodle in the chat room. Have you ever been to the chat room? Why not? Come on by, especially when the show is live, you know, during this time. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. It's free. It's easy. And Tim from L.A. says, thanks, Bob. I just laughed coffee through my nose. I'm sorry. That's what I heard when I was a kid. It is. So, you know, round young virgin. But, you know, there is the reason that I set the reading up the way I do is because part of that is from the book of Matthew and the other part is from the book of Luke. And what you find out is that there are two, just as there were probably dozens of stories back then about the birth of Yeshua. And because you'll notice that in the part that Margie and Doodle read, they've got little kid Jesus, not little baby Jesus, newborn, little kid Jesus living in a house in Bethlehem, which we find out in Luke they'd only gone to, Bethlehem was just a couple of days caravan ride. And they'd gone down there to basically participate in a census and maybe pay some sort of tax because they were from Nazareth, which is not Bethlehem. And so they boogie down to Nazareth, or boogie down from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and little Jesus is born in a manger because there was no room at the inn for round young virgins. But when you read the Matthew story, you've got the wise men visiting this little boy named Jesus who's living in a house in Bethlehem. Did they move? I mean, did a place open up and the reservation, then the concierge came to them there in the stable and say, yeah, well, we got a house down the road here you can have. I mean, all these shepherds and people coming along to visit and everything, it's getting a little crowded. So, and we hear there's another crowd on the way. So, you know, it looks bad for the town if we've got the kid laying in a manger here and the cattle trying to eat their hay. Around the baby. So, you know, why don't y'all come on down and move into the house? I don't know. Totally different stories. So we just, we don't know. And of course, there's the possibility that it's all a bunch of poppycock. The virgin birth most assuredly is. Not trying to ruin anything for anybody, but virgins don't have babies unless they're things like sharks. Primates don't do that. Parthenogenesis. It don't happen. On the other hand, if he existed and he said the things in his life that he said, it's a life worth noting, and probably stories rose up about his birth. I mean, heavens to Betsy, stories rise up, but not Texas Betsy, just a saying. Stories rise up about the auspices around the births of all kinds of people. You know, Doodle knows, for instance, that she was born under a comet, because she was. She was born in 1997 in the spring of the year when that, oh, what comet was it? I can't remember now. But it hung in the sky every evening, and that's how she came into the world, under a comet. Was that an auspice? We don't know. I tend not to go in for that kind of thing. But, you know, still, who's to say? It's a great story. Hail Bob. That was it. Thanks, Sparky. Hail Bob. To the phones we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello?
Hey, how you doing, Bob? This is Jumbo Jim calling from Tennessee.
Well, hey, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Just want to say, you know, you got a great show. Been listening for a while now. Well, I figured, you know, that tonight, you know, tied in Christmas Eve and all, I figured tonight's a perfect, you know, it's a good night to call in, I guess, you know. And was there, you know, you got some great kids, I particularly enjoy hearing them, whether you let them get behind the microphone.
Yeah, I can't, Jim, I can't turn them loose too often or they'll be unbearable.
Yeah.
Ferg wants to produce my show and he wants his own show. I'm not kidding. Yeah, Dad, when are you going to let me do a show? I don't know. When you've shown that you've, you know, absorbed some information and have something to talk about besides, you know, some, you know, Hollywood starlet or singer that drives you nuts.
Oh, yeah, but, you know. Yeah, but, you know, people in Hollywood, you know, whatever talent there is left in that place, you know, that's what they call, you know, like, you know, you know, whatever. I'm losing my train of thought here, but I don't know if you can tell, but I'm pretty nervous right now. But you know, I'm just working up the kinks, you know. But anyways, I'm just trying to say, you know, that you know. Are you still there?
No, I'm right here. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's pretty windy out here right now. I just want to make sure that you know. I didn't lose you or anything, still.
Well, if you don't mind me asking without giving away too much, what part of that great broad state of Tennessee are you in?
I'm calling from Clarksville, man.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
Yeah, just, you know, usually I could, you know, think out, you know, I can think out straight, you know, but whatever, I'm just nervous, you know, just, you know, I'm all over the place, you know. You know, one minute I'm talking about a I try to stay on subject, but then, you know, my nervousness just...
Well, don't, Jim, don't sweat it. We've never...
No, I mean...
We have not had a caller faint on the program yet, so you're doing just fine.
yeah, I know, man, but whew, I don't know how you guys do it, man, but, you know, right now, you know, my heart rate, you know, it's racing, and, but, anyways, Bob Berg, you know, I hear him... Seems like his voice is changing every day, you know. Like last time he was doing his whole Christmas, when he did this whole Christmas thing, you know, he sounded like a teenager, but then what I heard this year, he's starting to get, no, I'd watch out, Bob, you know, sooner or later he's going to start sound like you, man, and you know, I watch out, man, because you know, like he's gonna be, you know, a clone of you or whatever the proper term is.
Oh no, he's got all the good. He's got all the good from his mother and none of the bad from me. I have to say that I'm required by law to say that, Jim. but it is fun to hear him trying out the bass in his voice every now and then. You know, he'll take it down there.
That's the bass, man. I mean, you know, I mean, like I said, the bass is what's going to do it, you know, when, you know, I imagine, you know, as he gets older, you know, the bass, you know, just, that's going
to
be.
Yeah, see, one of his favorite songs used to be Stay by Jackson Browne. Are you familiar with
that? I've never heard of that one.
Well, there's a really, really high part of that. And he used to be able to sing it, and now he can't. He tried to launch into it the other day. He went, "What happened?" I said, "You know, puberty happened."
Yeah, it happens, man. Yeah, well.
So I just keep telling him, keep studying, keep reading, keep learning, and this is a terrible business to go into.
don't sell it short, Bob. Don't, I know, man. I mean. Shoot, we need good radio hosts out there, you know. I mean, sure, Tom, I have to. Thing is, if we lose the horn, you know, and if all I got left is this Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh, you know, it's like, you know, I must just get a noose, man, and just.
No. Stay away from the rope products, please, Jim.
or glue or anything I can inhale and just take. By my brain.
Well, if you do something like that, then you're ready to become a Limbaugh listener because you've killed your brain and you're ready for further instruction.
Oh yeah, my Where's my real Mike? Don't go ahead. No, no, I couldn't do that. No, I could not do that. No, no, just the filth they put up there, man. It's just, I mean, I was a modest fan of love, but as I, you know, matured, politically, I guess, you know, a bunch of the stuff that he said just, you know, doesn't have, you know, if you put a little bit of fun to it, you know, just really doesn't make a whole bunch of sense, you know. I mean, I understand I guess I do understand, you know, it's all about, you know, the market, the radio people, you know, they pay him enough, the advertisers keep him on the air. I mean, I guess that's how I believe it works anyways. And
pretty close.
Yeah, you know, it's such a shame. You know, I'm trying to say is that, you know, it's really too bad you guys, you know, aren't at least on satellite radio. I mean, at least you would, I imagine.
We continue to work at that, Jim. It just hasn't borne fruit yet, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, sure, I know that.
But, you know, they run commercials on satellite, too. So that would, you know, that would mean a significant change in the formatics of the program.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah, well.
But it would also broaden the audience considerably.
Yeah, but there would be a price that they wouldn't want the conversation poured into the radio. Oh, you know, you got to go to this next call. You got, you know, I mean, I don't know why Malloy has to do that because, you know, he's strapped with time. And, you know, and
well, there's all kinds of things that go with it.
I know that. Go ahead, man.
No. I was just going to say that the, you know, there are different things that obtain when you're doing terrestrial broadcasting. You've got to take into account station automation systems and stop tones and all kinds of crazy stuff. And you have to hit marks on the clock, or else everything at the affiliate station goes crazy and makes the program director mad, and you get hateful phone calls and. That's one of the reasons it's beautiful to be able to do the freeform stuff that we do here, and it makes these conversations possible.
Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, it's too bad I can't listen to, you know, you anywhere I want. I mean, unless I have some sort of, you know, wireless modem for my cell phone, which I don't have because that's too pricey. Right
oh, it now. Is too pricey, but eventually, you know, I think about Alan the trucker. Who calls in from time to time and would be all over the United States, and he listened, you know, he had one of those air cards for his computer and listened as he drove down the road. And
really?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, that day's coming, Jim. And the price, I hope, will eventually come down. You're right. Right now it's cripplingly expensive. When we're going to D.C. or Charleston or somewhere and we know that we're going to be doing a live event remotely, I have to pay for a month of what they call tethering at the cell phone company.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's just crippling. You can't get. Oh my God, it's awful, and it's no value for me around here anyway because I don't have the 3G broadband in this region. You know, we are, you know, in the hills and hollers and so forth. So none of that for us.
Right.
But you know, when we're in D.C. or some bigger area, there's 3G, and we can do that kind of thing. But it has a terrible expense to it, and eventually one hopes that the cost will come down. I imagine right now that the costs for that kind of thing are basically propping up the cost of building the infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my best guess.
Yeah, you know, of course, you know, it surprised me that, you know, the United States is slow on catching on to these things, you know. I mean, I imagine the rest of the planet, or at least most of the world anyways, has, you know, 3G internet, but what I was trying to say is that, you know, if I was able to, you know, somehow get my people I know, my work of listening to the horn, you know, maybe, you know, we start spreading out that way. And, you know, like I said, the air cards, but, you know, I didn't know that such an option existed. So, you know, I mean, if I can do something like that, yeah. I mean,
oh, yeah. Well, it's like $60 a month through either Verizon or AT&T. I don't know how much Sprint charges.
No, I couldn't.
And it's that's what I'm saying. It's crippling. It's just, it's ridiculous. Hey, Jim, I got to roll on. We're at the top of the hour, but awful good talking to you, and don't be so nervous next time. You got through it just fine. You're still alive, and every call gets a little bit easier.
Yeah, man. All right, well, thanks for taking my call, and I mean, I'll try calling more often, and shout out to everybody in the chat room.
Yeah, in the chat room, cool.
The chat room's awesome. It's pretty cool, man. You know, I'm very, very grateful to be, be in such a, nice community,
It's a fun little community, and it adds a sort of, real-time element to what goes on here. There's somebody in the chat room named Obi-Wan. Is that somebody being a different name? I don't know.
They probably changed it through a command.
I was going to say Tim from L.A. was being Geddy Lee for a little bit, but that was easy because he's such a Rush fan. You just know that's him.
I know. All right.
All right, you take.
I won't keep it too long. Bye.
All right, take care, Jim. Good to hear from you.
Have a Merry Christmas to you and your family, and say hi to Agnes for me.
I sure will. You take care now. Bye. Merry Christmas. Bye. Bye now.
Merry Christmas to you. Bye.
Calling from Tennessee. That's Jumbo Jim from the chat room. An email that rolled in, by the way, going back to poor Bunny from Parson, Kansas. Email rolled in from Juanita down in Florida. What in the world? You know, you'd like to hear Juanita's voice saying this. What in the world was this Bunny talking about? What is this division between her and her son? What have all the decorations to do with the birth of Christ? Perhaps she does not know that Christmas trees are from the Germanic religion. Most of what is observed here has nothing to do with Christians or Christ. Neither is Easter. In the First Testament, the old one, the tree worshippers were not pleasing to God. And then Juanita simply writes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because, that's the thing. We at least know what we're celebrating or not. And then there's the wing nuts. They don't let up. Oh, they don't take a holiday. Are you familiar with Build-A-Bear? It's a cute little place. There's one in the mall down in Charleston. They are exorbitantly expensive bears, but kids get to make their own stuffed toys, and there's a whole machine, and they sell little bear clothes and costumes, and it's a great racket. Because Lord knows, in years past, just having to walk past that place in the mall was enough to get the Kincaid kids into a full-on riot. I want 12 bears, Daddy! You know, when one's like $35, once you've got the chrome-plated exhaust and the dual mud flaps and the four-barrel carb on them and stuff. But anyway, it's a cute place, it's a neat process to watch the bear get made and everything. It's just sweet. Well, the Build-A-Bear, the company, the stores, have, of course, as any decent company in the first decade of the 21st century has, a web presence. And at their Build-A-Bear website, which is part of the Build-A-Bear workshop, they had some online videos for the holiday season. Because, remember, part of the non-Christian mythos of this season is that there is a jolly fat man who... See, Loney and Jasper aren't in the room yet, so we're in the clear. There's a jolly fat man who lives at the North Pole. And he's got a toy shop and there are elves, he's got elf labor. And Mrs. Claus lives there and he's got a stable full of reindeer, one of which has a perpetually red nose. And, I always wondered about Rudolph, wondered if he was in the sauce. But all that's up there, it's part of the myth and it's all at the North Pole. There's only one problem. Because of what we are doing to the planet, there's nothing solid for Santa Claus to live on at the North Pole anymore. You can take a cruise from the Atlantic to the Pacific through the North Polar region. And so the folks at Build-A-Bear
until fairly recently, had some online videos on their website that told children about man-made global warming and what it was doing to the North Pole. You know, and the polar bears and so forth. And little animals in the videos would learn about the problem and teach Santa Claus about it. This, of course, you know, just like Avatar does. What doesn't? This, of course, enraged the, yeah, I know, baggers, birthers, deathers, tenthers, booger eaters of the right wing. Wait, baggers, birthers, deathers, deniers, booger eaters, because they're global warming deniers, too. And it just it made them crazy. One wing nut was calling for the boycott of Build-A-Bear. Another one claimed that the videos are indoctrination of our cheerings. And so, what did Build-A-Bear do? Build-A-Bear caved. They took down the educational videos from their website. And they issued a statement from founder and chief executive Bear, Maxine Clark. Our goal is to entertain and engage the imagination of children with our stuffed animals, our store environment, and online. Our intention with the polar bear story was to inspire children through the voices of our animal characters to make a difference in their own individual ways. We did not intend to politicize the topic of global climate change or offend anyone in any way. The webisodes concluded this week with Santa successfully leaving on his journey to deliver gifts around the world. The webisodes will no longer be available on the site. They won another one. The Wingnuts. Because Build-A-Bear caved. I know. So we're going to take a little break. That other favorite Christmas carol of mine on the way. I Believe in Father Christmas. It's just beautiful. I'll run that, and then we'll come back and do a little reading, and then hopefully get Loney and Jasper in here for the night before Christmas. This is, of course, America's listener-supported liberal voice. Your support is what makes the horn continue. We're the horn, and we're proud of it. And we'll be back in just a minute.
They said there'll be snow at Christmas. They said there'll be peace on earth. But instead it just kept on raining. A veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember one Christmas morning, a winter's light and a distant choir, and the peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell. Eyes full of tinsel and fire. They sold me a dream of Christmas. They sold me a silent night. They told me a fairy story till I believed in the Israelite. And I believed in Father Christmas. I looked to the sky with excited eyes. Then I woke with a yawn in the first light of dawn. And I saw him through his disguise. Thank you.
Search your road and be clear. They said that he snowed Christmas. They said that he peace on earth. Hallelujah, Noel, be here on the Christmas we get, we deserve.
I'm going to add one more in just for Ferg, even though he's not in the room. We haven't played any Christmas music much during the season, but I'm going to add one more in here just because, well, you know, he'll be 14 day after tomorrow. And he is madly in love with this with this group. It's kind of like a cross between, I don't know, River Dance and the Spice Girls. Oh, dear. It's called Celtic Woman. And this is I almost hesitate to play this because it's like some sort of a curse. No, don't let it snow. We've had enough snow. Thanks. Thanks for the snow. Enough already. Oh, I think I just won the Scrooge Award. But at any rate, he loves this. And I was ordered to play it. And lo and behold, as if on cue, Ferg...
You played Celtic Woman, Let It Snow?
See?
It's the most favorite song of mine because I like the one in the pink. Her name is Chloe Agnew.
You see?
Wait till you hear her voice. It'll drive you insane.
Isn't puberty hell? Yeah. So let's get this going and get this over with.
Love the form, so we hope you enjoy it.
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. And
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
About 15 past the hour, and a little piece that Lottie in the chat room, one of our moderators in the chat room, helped me find, because I used to have the link saved to it, but the that was about three dead computers ago. So Lottie helped me dig this up again. And it, what it is it's a short story, and it is my single favorite piece of holiday literature, I suppose. It's a short story by Truman Capote called A Christmas Memory. And I guess it speaks to me because, being of the age that I am, growing up, my parents were older than all the other kids' parents I grew up with. Because my parents were 40 when I was born. Which meant that as a kid born on the tail end of the baby boom, I actually had parents who remembered the Depression and grandparents who remembered the First World War. And things before that. And so the time that this story describes is not so foreign to me, and probably not foreign to many of you. I don't know if it still resonates with younger folk or not. Hopefully good writing always resonates. But, and, you know, it takes place in rural Alabama. And in reading this, I see places and hear things that are recognizable to me. A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote. Imagine a morning in late November, a coming of winter morning years and years ago. Consider the kitchen of a spreading old house in a country town. A great black stove is its main feature, but there is also a big round table and a fireplace with two rocking chairs placed in front of it. Just today, the fireplace commenced its seasonal roar. A woman with shorn hair is standing at the kitchen window. She's wearing tennis shoes and a shapeless gray sweater over a summery calico dress. She is small and sprightly like a bantam hen, but due to a long, youthful illness, her shoulders are pitifully hunched. Her face is remarkable, not unlike Lincoln's, craggy like that, and tinted by sun and wind, but it is delicate, too, finely boned, and her eyes are sherry-colored and timid. "Oh, my," she exclaims, her breath smoking the window pane. "It's fruitcake weather." The person to whom she is speaking is myself. I am 7. She is 60-something. We are cousins, very distant ones, and we have lived together, well, as long as I can remember. Other people inhabit the house, relatives, and though they have power over us and frequently make us cry, we are not, on the whole, too much aware of them. We are each other's best friend. She calls me Buddy, in memory of a boy who was formerly her best friend. The other Buddy died in the 1880s, when she was still a child. She is still a child. "I knew it before I got out of bed," she says, turning away from the window with a purposeful excitement in her eyes. "The courthouse bell sounded so cold and clear, and there were no birds singing. They've gone to warmer country. Yes, indeed. Oh, Buddy, stop stuffing biscuit and fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat. We've 30 cakes to bake." It's always the same. A morning arrives in November, and my friend, as though officially inaugurating the Christmas time of year that exhilarates her imagination and fuels the blaze of her heart, announces, "It's fruitcake weather. Fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat." The hat is found, a straw cartwheel corsaged with velvet roses out of doors has faded it. It once belonged to a more fashionable relative. Together we guide our buggy, a dilapidated baby carriage, out to the garden and into a grove of pecan trees. The buggy is mine. That is, it was bought for me when I was born. It is made of wicker, rather unraveled, and the wheels wobble like a drunkard's legs. But it is a faithful object. Springtimes we take it to the woods and fill it with flowers, herbs, wild fern for our porch pots. In the summer we pile it with picnic paraphernalia and sugarcane fishing poles and roll it down to the edge of a creek. It has its winter uses, too, as a truck for hauling firewood from the yard to the kitchen, as a warm bed for Queenie, our tough little orange and white rat terrier who has survived distemper and two rattlesnake bites. Queenie is trotting beside it now. 3 hours later, we are back in the kitchen hauling a heaping buggy load of windfall pecans. Our backs hurt from gathering them. How hard they were to find, the main crop having been shaken off the trees and sold by the orchard's owners, who are not us, among the concealing leaves. The frosted, deceiving grass. Crackle! A cheery crunch. Scraps of miniature thunder sound as the shells collapse, and the golden mound of sweet, oily, ivory meat mounts in the milk glass bowl. Queenie begs to taste, and now and again my friend sneaks her a mite, though insisting we deprive ourselves. We mustn't, buddy. If we start, we won't stop, and there's scarcely enough as there is for 30 cakes. The kitchen is growing dark. Dusk turns the window into a mirror. Our reflections mingle with the rising moon as we work by the fireside in the firelight. At last, when the moon is quite high, we toss the final hull into the fire and with joined sighs watch it catch flame. The buggy is empty. The bowl is brimful. We eat our supper, cold biscuits, bacon, blackberry jam, and discuss tomorrow. Tomorrow, the kind of work I like best begins. Buying. Cherries and citron, ginger and vanilla, and canned Hawaiian pineapple. Rinds and raisins and walnuts and whiskey and, oh, so much flour, butter, so many eggs, spices, flavorings. Why, we'll need a pony to pull the buggy home. But before these purchases can be made, there is the question of money. Neither of us has any. Except for skinflint sums persons in the house occasionally provide, a dime is considered very big money, or what we earn ourselves from various activities, holding rummage sales, selling buckets of hand-picked blackberries, jars of homemade jam and apple jelly and peach preserves, rounding up flowers for funerals and weddings. Once we won 79th prize, $5, in a national football contest. Not that we know a fool thing about football, it's just that we enter any contest we hear about. At the moment, our hopes are centered on the $50,000 grand prize being offered to name a new brand of coffee. We suggested AM, and after some hesitation, for my friend thought it perhaps sacrilegious, the slogan, AM, Amen. To tell the truth, our only really profitable enterprise was the Fun and Freak Museum we conducted in a backyard woodshed 2 summers ago. The fun was a stereopticon with slide views of Washington and New York lent us by a relative who had been to those places. She was furious when she discovered why we'd borrowed it. The freak was a three-legged biddy chicken hatched by one of our own hens. Everybody hereabouts wanted to see that biddy. We charged grown-ups a nickel, kids 2 cents, and took in a good $20 before the museum shut down due to the decease of the main attraction. But one way and another, we do each year accumulate Christmas savings, a fruitcake fund. These monies we keep hidden in an ancient bead purse under a loose board, under the floor, under a chamber pot, under my friend's bed. The purse is seldom removed from this safe location except to make a deposit or, as happens every Saturday, a withdrawal. For on Saturdays, I'm allowed 10 cents to go to the picture show. My friend has never been to a picture show, nor does she intend to. I'd rather hear you tell the story, buddy. That way I can imagine it more. Besides, a person my age shouldn't squander their eyes. When the Lord comes, let me see him clear. In addition to never having seen a movie, she has never eaten in a restaurant, traveled more than 5 miles from home, received or sent a telegram, read anything except funny papers and the Bible, worn cosmetics, cursed, wished someone harm, told a lie on purpose, let a hungry dog go hungry. Here are a few things she has done, does do. Killed with a hoe, the biggest rattlesnake ever seen in this county, 16 rattles. Dip snuff, secretly. Tame hummingbirds, just try it, till they balance on her finger. Tell ghost stories. We both believe in ghosts. So tingling they chill you in July. Talk to herself. Take walks in the rain. Grow the prettiest japonicas in town. Know the recipe for every sort of old-time Indian cure, including a magical wart remover. Now, with supper finished, we retire to the room in a faraway part of the house where my friend sleeps in a scrap quilt-covered iron bed painted rose pink, her favorite color. Silently, wallowing in the pleasures of conspiracy, we take the bead purse from its secret place and spill its contents on the scrap quilt. Dollar bills, tightly rolled and green as maybuds, somber 50-cent pieces, heavy enough to weight a dead man's eyes. Lovely dimes, the liveliest coin, the one that really jingles. Nickels and quarters worn smooth as creek pebbles, but mostly a hateful heap of bitter-odored pennies. Last summer, others in the house contracted to pay us a penny for every 25 flies we killed. Oh, the carnage of August, the flies that flew to heaven. Yet it was not work in which we took pride. And as we sit counting pennies, it is as though we were back-tabulating dead flies. Neither of us has a head for figures. We count slowly, lose track, start again. According to her calculations, we have $12.73. According to mine, exactly $13. I do hope you're wrong, buddy. We can mess around. We can't mess around with 13. The cakes will fall or put somebody in the cemetery. Why, I wouldn't dream of getting out of bed on the 13th. This is true. She always spends 13ths in bed. So to be on the safe side, we subtract a penny and toss it out the window. Of the ingredients that go into our fruitcakes, whiskey is the most expensive as well as the hardest to obtain. State laws forbid its sale. But everybody knows you can buy a bottle from Mr. Ha Ha Jones. And the next day, having completed our more prosaic shopping, we set out for Mr. Ha Ha's business address, a sinful, to quote public opinion, fish fry and dancing cafe down by the river. We've been there before, and on the same errand. But in previous years, our dealings have been with Ha Ha's wife, an iodine dark Indian woman with brassy peroxided hair and a dead tired disposition. Actually, we've never laid eyes on her husband, though we've heard that he's an Indian too, a giant with razor scars across his cheeks. They call him Ha Ha because he's so gloomy, a man who never laughs. As we approach his cafe, a large log cabin festooned inside and out, with chains of garish, gay, naked light bulbs, and standing by the river's muddy edge under the shade of river trees where moss drifts through the branches like gray mist, our steps slow down. Even Queenie stops prancing and sticks close by. People have been murdered in Ha Ha's cafe, cut to pieces, hit on the head. There's a case coming up in court next month. Naturally, these goings-on happen at night when the colored lights cast crazy patterns on the Victrola wall and the Victrola whales. In the daytime, Ha Ha's is shabby and deserted. I knock at the door. Queenie barks. My friend calls, Mrs. Ha Ha, ma'am, anyone to home? Footsteps. The door opens. Our hearts overturn. It's Mr. Ha Ha Jones himself. And he is a giant. He does have scars. He doesn't smile. No, he glowers at us through Satan-tilted eyes and demands to know what you want with Ha Ha. For a moment, we are too paralyzed to tell. Presently, my friend half finds her voice, a whispery voice at best. If you please, Mr. Ha Ha, we'd like a quart of your finest whiskey. His eyes tilt more. Would you believe it? Ha Ha is smiling. Laughing, too. Which one of you is a drinking man? It's for making fruit cakes, Mr. Ha Ha. Cooking. This sobers him. He frowns. That's no way to waste good whiskey. Nevertheless, he retreats into the shadowed cafe and seconds later appears carrying a bottle of daisy yellow unlabeled liquor. He demonstrates its sparkle in the sunlight and says, $2. We pay him with nickels and dimes and pennies. Suddenly, as he jingles the coins in his hands like a fistful of dice, his face softens. Tell you what, he proposes, pouring the money back into our bead purse. Just send me one of them fruitcakes instead. Well, my friend remarks on our way home, there's a lovely man. We'll put an extra cup of raisins in his cake. The black stove, stoked with coal and firewood, glows like a lighted pumpkin. Egg beaters whirl, spoons spin round in bowls of butter and sugar. Vanilla sweetens the air, ginger spices it. Melting, nose-tingling odors saturate the kitchen, suffuse the house, drift out to the world on puffs of chimney smoke. In 4 days, our work is done. 31 cakes, dampened with whiskey, bask on windowsills and shelves. Who are they for? Friends. Not necessarily neighbor friends, indeed. The larger share is intended for persons we've met maybe once, perhaps not at all. People who've struck our fancy, like President Roosevelt, like the Reverend and Mrs. J.C. Lucy, Baptist missionaries to Borneo, who lectured here last winter. Or the little knife grinder who comes through town twice a year. Or Abner Packer, the driver of the 6 o'clock bus from Mobile, who exchanges waves with us every day as he passes in a dust cloud whoosh. Or the young Whistons, a California couple whose car one afternoon broke down outside the house and who spent a pleasant hour chatting with us on the porch. Young Mr. Whiston snapped our picture, the only one we've ever had taken. Is it because my friend is shy with everyone except strangers that these strangers and merest acquaintances seem to us our truest friends? I think yes. Also, the scrapbooks we keep of thank yous on White House stationery, time-to-time communications from California and Borneo, the knife grinder's penny postcards make us feel connected to eventful worlds beyond the kitchen with its view of a sky that stops. Now, a nude December fig branch grates against the window. The kitchen is empty. The cakes are gone. Yesterday, we carted the last of them to the post office, where the cost of stamps turned our purse inside out. We're broke. That rather depresses me, but my friend insists on celebrating with 2 inches of whiskey left in Ha Ha's bottle. Queenie has a spoonful in a bowl of coffee. She likes her coffee chicory-flavored and strong. The rest we divide between a pair of jelly glasses. We're both quite awed at the prospect of drinking straight whiskey. The taste of it brings screwed-up expressions and sour shudders, but by and by we begin to sing, the two of us singing different songs simultaneously. I don't know the words to mine, just come on along to the Darktown Strutters Ball. But I can dance. That's what I mean to be, a tap dancer in the movies. My dancing shadow rollicks on the walls, our voices rock the chinaware. We giggle as if unseen hands were tickling us. Queenie rolls on her back, her paws plow the air, smelling something like a grin stretches her black lips. Inside myself, I feel warm and sparky as those crumbling logs, carefree as the wind in the chimney. My friend waltzes round the stove, the hem of her poor calico skirt pinched between her fingers as though it were a party dress. "Show me the way to go home," she sings, her tennis shoes squeaking on the floor. "Show me the way to go home." Enter two relatives, very angry, potent with eyes that scold, tongues that scald. Listen to what they have to say, the words tumbling together into a wrathful tune. "A child of 7. Whiskey on his breath. Are you out of your mind? Feeding a child of 7 must be loony. Road to ruination. Remember Cousin Kate, Uncle Charlie, Uncle Charlie's brother-in-law? Shame, scandal, humiliation. Kneel, pray, beg the Lord." Queenie sneaks under the stove. My friend gazes at her shoes. Her chin quivers. She lifts her skirt and blows her nose and runs to her room. Long after the town has gone to sleep and the house is silent except for the chimings of clocks and the sputter of fading fires, she is weeping into a pillow already as wet as a widow's handkerchief. "Don't cry," I say, sitting at the bottom of her bed and shivering despite my flannel nightgown that smells of last winter's cough syrup. "Don't cry," I beg, teasing her toes, tickling her feet. "You're too old for that." "It's because," she hiccups, "I am too old. Old and funny." "Not funny. Fun. More fun than anybody. Listen, if you don't stop crying, you'll be so tired tomorrow we can't go cut a tree." She straightens up. Queenie jumps on the bed, where Queenie is not allowed, to lick her cheeks.
I know where we'll find real pretty trees, buddy, and holly, too, with berries big as your eyes. It's way off in the woods, farther than we've ever been. Papa used to bring us Christmas trees from there, carry them on his shoulder. That's 50 years ago. Well, now I can't wait for morning. Morning. Frozen rime lusters the grass, the sun round as an orange as hot weather moons, balances on the horizon, burnishes the silvered winter woods. A wild turkey calls. A renegade hog grunts in the undergrowth. Soon, by the edge of knee-deep, rapid-running water, we have to abandon the buggy. Queenie wades the stream first, paddles across, barking complaints at the swiftness of the current, the pneumonia-making coldness of it. We follow, holding our shoes and equipment, a hatchet, a burlap sack above our heads. A mile more of chastising thorns, burrs, bristles, and briars that catch at our clothes, of rusty pine needles, brilliant with gaudy fungus and molded feathers. Here, there, a flash, a flutter, an ecstasy of shrillings remind us that not all the birds have flown south. Always the path unwinds through lemony sun pools and pitch-black vine tunnels. Another creek to cross, a disturbed armada of speckled trout froths the water round us, and frogs the size of plates practice belly flops. Beaver workmen are building a dam. On the farther shore, Queenie shakes herself and trembles. My friend shivers, too, not with cold, but enthusiasm. One of her hat's ragged roses sheds a petal as she lifts her head and inhales the pine-heavy air. We're almost there. Can you smell it, buddy? She says, as though we were approaching an ocean. And indeed, it is a kind of ocean. Scented acres of holiday trees, prickly-leafed holly, red berries shiny as Chinese bells, black crows swoop upon them screaming. Having stuffed our burlap sacks with enough greenery and crimson to garland a dozen windows, we set about choosing a tree. It should be, muses my friend, twice as tall as a boy, so a boy can't steal the star. The one we pick is twice as tall as me, a brave, handsome brute that survives 30 hatchet strokes before it keels with a creaking, rending cry. Lugging it like a kill, we commence the long trek out. Every few yards we abandon the struggle, sit down and pant, but we have the strength of triumphant huntsmen, and that and the tree's virile, icy perfume revive us, goad us on. Many compliments accompany our sunset return along the red clay road to town, but my friend is sly and noncommittal when passers-by praise the treasure perched in our buggy. What a fine tree, and where did it come from? Yonder ways, she murmurs vaguely. Once a car stops and the rich mill owner's lazy wife leans out and whines, give you 2 bits cash for that old tree. Ordinarily, my friend is afraid of saying no, but on this occasion she promptly shakes her head. We wouldn't take a dollar. The mill owner's wife persists, a dollar my foot, 50 cents, that's my last offer. Goodness, woman, you can get another one. In answer, my friend gently reflects, I doubt it. There's never two of anything. Home. Queenie slumps by the fire and sleeps till tomorrow, snoring loud as a human. A trunk in the attic contains a shoebox of ermine tails off the opera cape of a curious lady who once rented a room in the house. Coils of frazzled tinsel gone gold with age, one silver star, a brief rope of dilapidated, undoubtedly dangerous, candy-like light bulbs. Excellent decorations as far as they go, which isn't far enough. My friend wants our tree to blaze like a Baptist window. Droop with weighty snows of ornament, but we can't afford the made-in-Japan splendors at the five and dime. So we do what we've always done. Sit for days at the kitchen table with scissors and crayons and stacks of colored paper. I make sketches and my friend cuts them out. Lots of cats, fish too, because they're easy to draw. Some apples, some watermelons, a few winged angels devised from saved-up sheets of Hershey bar tinfoil. We use safety pins to attach these creations to the tree. As a final touch, we sprinkle the branches with shredded cotton picked in August for this purpose. My friend, surveying the effect, claps her hands together. Now, honest, buddy, doesn't it look good enough to eat? Queenie tries to eat an angel. After weaving and ribboning holly wreath for all the front windows, our next project is fashioning of family gifts. Tie-dye scarves for the ladies. For the men, a home-brewed lemon and licorice and aspirin syrup to be taken at the first symptoms of a cold and after hunting. But when it comes time for making each other's gift, my friend and I separate to work secretly. I would like to buy her a pearl-handled knife, a radio, a whole pound of chocolate-covered cherries. We tasted some once, and she always swears, I could live on them, buddy. Lord, yes, I could. And that's not taking his name in vain. Instead, I'm building her a kite. She would like to give me a bicycle. She said so on several million occasions. If only I could, buddy. It's bad enough in life to do without something you want. But confound it, what gets my goat is not being able to give somebody something you want them to have. Only one of these days I will, buddy, locate you a bike. Don't ask how. Steal it, maybe. Instead, I'm fairly certain that she is building me a kite. Same as last year, and the year before that, we exchanged slingshots. All of which is fine by me, for we are champion kite flyers who study the wind like sailors. My friend, more accomplished than I, can get a kite aloft when there isn't enough breeze to carry clouds. Christmas Eve afternoon, we scrape together a nickel and go to the butcher's to buy Queenie's traditional gift, a good gnawable beef bone. The bone, wrapped in funny paper, is placed high in the tree near the silver star. Queenie knows it's there. She squats at the foot of the tree, staring up in a trance of greed. When bedtime arrives, she refuses to budge. Her excitement is equaled by my own. I kick the covers and turn my pillow as though it were a scorching summer's night. Somewhere a rooster crows falsely, for the sun is still on the other side of the world. Buddy, are you awake? It is my friend, calling from her room, which is next to mine, and an instant later she is sitting on my bed holding a candle. Well, I can't sleep a hoot, she declares. My mind's jumping like a jackrabbit. Buddy, do you think Mrs. Roosevelt will serve our cake at dinner? We huddle in the bed and she squeezes my hand. I love you. It seems like your hand used to be so much smaller. I guess I hate to see you grow up. When you're grown up, will we still be friends? I say always. But I feel so bad, buddy. I wanted so bad to give you a bike. I tried to sell my cameo Papa gave me. Buddy, she hesitates as though embarrassed. I made you another kite. Then I confess that I made her one, too, and we laugh. The candle burns too short to hold. Out it goes, exposing the starlight, the stars spinning at the window like a visible caroling that slowly, slowly, daybreak silences. Possibly we doze, but the beginnings of dawn splash us like cold water. We're up, wide-eyed and wandering, while we wait for others to waken. Quite deliberately, my friend drops a kettle on the kitchen floor. I tap dance in front of closed doors. One by one, the household emerges, looking as though they'd like to kill us both. But it's Christmas, so they can't. First, a gorgeous breakfast, just everything you can imagine, from flapjacks and fried squirrel to hominy grits and honey in the comb, which puts everyone in a good humor except my friend and me. Frankly, we're so impatient to get at the presents, we can't eat a mouthful. Well, I'm disappointed. Who wouldn't be? With socks, a Sunday school shirt, some handkerchiefs, a hand-me-down sweater, and a year's subscription to a religious magazine for children, The Little Shepherd. It makes me boil. It really does. My friend has a better haul, a sack of satsumas. That's her best present. She is proudest, however, of a white wool shawl knitted by her married sister. But she says her favorite gift is the kite I built her. And it is very beautiful, though not as beautiful as the one she made me, which is blue and scattered with gold and green good conduct stars. Moreover, my name is painted on it. Buddy. Buddy, the wind is blowing. The wind is blowing, and nothing will do till we've run to a pasture below the house where Queenie has scooted to bury her bone, and where a winter hence, Queenie will be buried too. There, plunging through the healthy, waist-high grass, we unreel our kites, feel them twitching at the string like skyfish as they swim into the wind. Satisfied, sun-warmed, we sprawl in the grass and peel satsumas and watch our kites cavort. Soon I forget the socks and hand-me-down sweater.
I'm as happy as if we'd already won the $50,000 grand prize in that coffee naming contest. My, how foolish I am, my friend cries, suddenly alert, like a woman remembering too late she has biscuits in the oven. You know what I've always thought, she asks in a tone of discovery and not smiling at me, but at a point beyond. I've always thought a body would have to be sick and dying before they saw the Lord. And I imagined that when he came, it would be like looking at the Baptist window, pretty as colored glass with the sun pouring through, such a shine you don't know it's getting dark. And it's been a comfort to think of that shine taking away all the spooky feeling, but I'll wager it never happens. I'll wager at the very end a body realizes the Lord has already shown himself, that things as they are, her hand circles in a gesture that gathers clouds and kites and grass and queenie paw and earth over her bone. Just what they've always seen was seeing him. As for me, I could leave the world with today in my eyes. This is our last Christmas together. Life separates us. Those who know best decide that I belong in a military school. And so follows a miserable succession of bugle-blowing prisons, grim reveille-ridden summer camps. I have a new home, too, but it doesn't count. Home is where my friend is, and there I never go. And there she remains, puttering around the kitchen, alone with Queenie, then alone. Buddy dear, she writes in her wild, hard-to-read script, yesterday Jim Macy's horse kicked Queenie bad. Be thankful she didn't feel much. I wrapped her in a fine linen sheet and rode her in the buggy down to Simpson's pasture, where she can be with all her bones. For a few Novembers, she continues to bake her fruitcakes single-handed. Not as many, but some. And, of course, she always sends me the best of the batch. Also, in every letter, she encloses a dime wadded in toilet paper. See a picture show and write me the story. But gradually, in her letters, she tends to confuse me with her other friend, the buddy who died in the 1880s. More and more, 13ths are not the only days she stays in bed. A morning arrives in November, a leafless, birdless coming of winter morning, when she cannot rouse herself to exclaim, "Oh my, it's fruitcake weather." And when that happens, I know it. A message saying so merely confirms a piece of news some secret vein had already received, severing from me an irreplaceable part of myself, letting it loose like a kite on a broken string. That is why, walking across a school campus on this particular December morning, I keep searching the sky, as if I expected to see, rather like hearts, a lost pair of kites hurrying toward heaven. I do love that story. And so it's about 14 minutes before the hour. I'm going to find some little piece of Christmas. And take a moment to run and get Loney and Jasper brought in here. I hope you don't mind this. But we'll do that reading. And then we'll be away for Christmas, which is tomorrow, but back on Monday. And we'll crank it up again. But like Malloy noted last night in that magnificent script prepared by Bob Alexander, For one day we get a respite from the right-wing hate and the right-wing misery and the vileness of everything that they intend toward us, and we turn instead toward family and cherish them. And with that in mind, that's part of reading the night before Christmas to the little ones. And it's part of the memories and the remembering and the naming that we do and the thinking that we do. You know, every night I try to give credit where credit is due to everyone who makes this program possible. But inevitably, I always fail. But it would be, if there is such a thing as sin, it would be a sin on an evening like this not to remember each and every one of you. All of you who email your thoughts, your impressions of why things are the way they are. Those of you who, when you can and do, try to make sure that we stay on the air via your financial contributions. A lot of people have come and gone within the structure of the horn since its inception, and we hope someday they'll be back. I got a lovely little e-card this morning from Peter Godbold and Doggy. And seldom does the day go by that I don't think fondly of him and hope that he is well on the road to his own recovery. And I trust that is continuing apace. Peter Godbold, John Fox. I don't think the story has ever been told of the work that Ben Birch has poured into making sure that this program and so many others are available to people on the Internet who might not otherwise, you know, terrestrial radio being what it is, ever have access to something like liberal or progressive radio programming. There's a whole bunch of this country that lives in broadcast darkness, for whom Ben Birch and the White Rose Society has served as a beacon of light. And he's been doing it since 2002. That just astonishes me. The dedication. The sheer grit that it takes to keep something like that going. Literally against all odds. Sue in Ohio, ELO in the chat room, who is ever ready to handle any request within reason, from songs to blog posts and so forth. So much of this doesn't happen without her. Haven't heard from Guy James in a while, but I do need to let you know that Guy will be, he's trying to get back on the air, but he is facing some real difficulties that are getting in the way of that. I expect to be hearing from him sometime in the new year. Friends who have come and gone, Joe Vecchio, I think of often, and the power and passion he brought to broadcasting. Rick Goodner, who just, well, took some time away, maybe back, we don't know. Think of him all the time. Bruce Birch was with us at the beginning. I hope he's doing okay. Billy Shears, who over the course of a couple of years made Saturday nights, made Saturday nights ever so enjoyable. There's a lot of folks that have made a lot of impressions, not just on you, but on us here. Bob Lottie in the chat room. Gene and Susan, the news ninjas, whose ability to find stuff to keep these shows interesting is rising to the status of legendary. And Texas Betsy, our blogger, who has an absolute nose for seeing stuff that she knows that will somehow appeal to me and make the show better. So much goes into so much of this that it astonishes me. And then behind it all, of course, Boss Man Wayne, who made it all happen to start, and remains to this day integrally involved in keeping it going. And like I mention every night, there's Gina, who was the very origin of the idea that something like this could happen. So many of you, so many people, and we barely even know the story that we ourselves are making as we go along. And so let me simply say thank you to all of you, named and unnamed. Thank you for all that you do. It is an amazing, amazing thing that we do together. So we'll crank up a little song here, and I will go and get the babies in here, and we'll wrap up this Christmas Eve edition of The Horn. Be right back.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering the simple phrase to kids from one 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know. From 1 to 92.
it's been said many times, many ways. Merry Christmas to you.
And the fact of the matter is, that Merry Christmas Johnny Mathis album is deeply steeped in the family tradition around here. I can't remember a Christmas as a child when that wasn't playing on the record player. And yes, the noises you hear in the background are in fact the next generation as they Oh, let's catch this. What's that, Loney? Oh, thank you, Loney. So we'll just wrap this up. Might take a couple of minutes over, but I don't think there's any harm in that this evening. We'll just wrap this up with a little more Christmas tradition. Clement Clark Moore wrote this in the 19th century, and almost single-handedly invented the American Christmas with it. We recognize it as the night before Christmas, but the fact of the matter is, the name of it is A Visit from St. Nicholas. Hey, Jasper. What are you doing, Jasper? I know. All right, guys, you ready? You ready, Loney? Ready, okay. You ready, Jasper? No, that's okay. Are you losing a lung there, Lila? Okay, ready to read for Liza. Right. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled down for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. Reindeer, that's right. With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen. On Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now dash away, dash away. Dash away all. As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler, just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled. His dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses. His nose, like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow.
That was funny, though.
The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed, like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf. And I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work, and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team, gave a whistle, and away they all flew, like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Yay.
Merry Christmas, Loney.
Say ho, ho, ho.
And soon you will go to sleep so Santa can get here. Oh, thank you, Loney. And to all of you who are part of this extended horn family, from all of us,
Merry Christmas! And a Happy New Year!
He wants to direct.
Oh, I hear you.
Yes, we hear you, sweetheart.
I love you all.
So I guess that's it for us. And we'll catch you on Monday. I hope your holiday is as blissful and as happy as it can possibly be. So Merry Christmas. And we'll call it an end for the evening. Oh. Love you, Lonnie.
Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas, Lonnie.
Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Adoremus, venite, adoremus.